Do I need to turn the TV down, man? Okay.
You're listening to Cooper Talk.
Welcome to Cooper Talk. I'm your host, Steve Cooper. And remember, I'm only as hip as my guests. And I got to tell you, people, this gentleman was on my show in April 11 years ago, and on my show in April 9 years ago. And at the time, I recorded at this studio on Olive Avenue right there in Burbank. And it was a great little place. And I was so happy when he came down. And he's got a documentary now called Hendry. And my guest is Phil Hendry. How you doing, Phil?
Hey, Stephen. I was looking for our recent email exchanges, so I had the Zoom address properly. And it was pulling up 2015, and it was pulling up 2013, all these... I said, oh, my God, I still have these in the file, these old emails that we exchanged.
Well, it's so, funny. Yeah. It's funny because the time, and you know, you've been in the radio for a long time. Time passes. I just passed my 1,000th episode. And I was like,
congratulations, man.
Thank you. I was like, wow. And then you sit there and then you forget who's been on. And then you're watching a movie and you go, holy shit, that person's been on. But I want to talk about movies. I watched a documentary last night and I really enjoyed it. And I want to ask you, you know, as I'm watching it, Bill Hader and Henry Rollins, they're all mentioning, you know, the first time they heard you. And I still remember, this is how you put an impact on people. I still remember the first time I heard you. I was, it was my first marriage and we lived in San Diego, but I came to LA Sunday night through Thursday. I had this little shitty studio in Hollywood and I'm driving down, stuck in that traffic on a Thursday. And all of a sudden, I flip around the radio and I hear this. You, who I wasn't familiar with, and this old grumpy guy who was in the Midwest and his son had fallen out of a Ferris wheel. And I still remember that. And at first I'm going, what is this? I'm like, wow. And then finally I got the joke and I laughed my ass off. But do you remember stuff like that? Because you've done so many characters.
I remember that bit exactly. And the fact that you brought up, you're the first person to bring that bit up. And I remember I worked that thing really weird. It was Harvey Wireman, who's an attorney, a former Marine. He was in the South Pacific during World War II, and then he went to work for the ACLU. He's kind of based on F. Lee Bailey, but he had a voice like this, and he did something that a lot of old guys do. They have, you know, always clearing the phlegm out of the throat. But my son, he fell out of a Ferris wheel. Yeah, and I think he bounced from bucket to bucket till he hit the ground or something. But what the hook was, I don't remember. I know it was in Indiana, and I think he was saying his life before he got to L.A. You know, I'm from Indiana, Phil, and we lost our son. He just bounced from one bucket to the next, and I just stared at this. I don't know, man. So,
how does that make you feel as a creator? When, like, I remember that, and that was from ages ago, and Hader, and the documentary remembered stuff, and Rollins did, and Kevin Pollak. Everyone remembered these bits, and these are heavy hitters in the comedy world. How does that make you feel as a creator that you put that impact on people and you've influenced people?
Well, it comes as a complete surprise. When I first heard it, it came as a complete surprise to me because, as I said to friends in recent days, I wanted to come back to Los Angeles because I grew up here, and the best place to be when you're working on the air is the town you grew up in. And I wanted to give full vent to the creative impulses that I had. That was my goal. I had no idea, man, when I got here that anybody in comedy would be listening to me. I thought I would just have listeners. I would have cats that would come up to me who were like, hey, Phil, I work in construction. You're really funny. Great, thank you. That's what I thought, you know. And that I'd get a whole bunch of those guys and that I'd be able to keep my job for longer than 2 years. That's the life of radio, you know. I had no idea I'd make any money. I had no bloody idea that anybody that... in show business would dig me, least of all comedy guys, which I considered to be a whole other world beyond personality talk radio. And so it came as a surprise. I have a hard time still believing it, to be perfectly honest with you, that people like what I do that much. But I'm gratified, man, because it's given a whole new impetus to my career, you know.
And it's funny because, you know, I'm doing stand-up again, but I did it for 8 years back in the day, and I was on the road. And comics, you know, comics always bitch. That guy didn't deserve a break, or that guy didn't deserve a break. But you're one of the guys everyone respects. I remember the first time you were on, this guy, John DeCrosta, who's a comic. Big fan of yours.
He was a guest. I know Johnny. He's a great guy.
He was a guest before you. And he's like, can I hang out? Can I hang out? And I'm like, yeah. And it was just amazing to see the influence you had on people. And as I said, comics, you know, we can be a bitter little bunch. But they all just liked you.
Well, I And the fact they thought I was funny. Can you hear that? There's a saw now going outside here. There's somebody, actually, there's someone who is on a prominent television show building a house behind me. So in the morning, all I hear is ranchero music because the cement finishers are all cats that come from Mexico or I'm hearing guys with saws. So could you repeat your question? No, I'm kidding. How does it make say that again?
No, I was saying how, you know, comics, they just like you. And that must be a great feeling. There's not that, like, animosity, like, oh, screw that guy. Like, Matt Rife was out, and they're like, oh, he's got abs. That's why he's getting breaks. I'm like, well, the guy works. You know, people don't understand. Yeah. It does take a – you just don't become famous overnight.
Yeah, I don't think so. I don't know if there's anybody that has a, you know, a real problem with me. I think I heard once, I shouldn't drop a name, but, and I feel bad if this is true. If this isn't true, please tell me. But I heard that Johnny Knoxville thought I was some kind of an asshole. And I think I know why. I think I was sarcastic about his show, Jackass. Maybe we did a bit that made fun of it. I don't know, you know, and I am really, really sorry if truly sorry if I offended good people, you know, but I tried to keep my head down. Steve, and I try to just do my freaking job. I try to be as funny as I can, and I try to get home with my job intact. And when someone says to me that, Kevin Pollak wants to interview me, or you want to interview me, or people in the world of comedy, I am genuinely, or at least I was genuinely surprised that they would take time out of their lives to talk to a guy like me who doesn't do stand-up. And I consider stand-up to be one of the toughest things in all of show business to do. I can't think of – it scares the hell out of me, man. My hat's off to you, bro, for trying it for 8 years, you know?
Well, you know what I think it also is, though, with you? You know, a lot of us, like, I grew up, my introduction to comedy was my older brother and the Cheech and Chong albums. And you think the Cheech and Chong albums were a sketch. You know, they had, you know, Dear... And so I think with you, it's not stand-up, it's a concept. And when you get it, you get it.
Right. The only thing that I can do from what I do on stage is to bring these characters to life. We're not doing any phone call goofs. I just did a UCB show with James Adomian. It was support for Armenia. It was a benefit show. And there were stand-ups and there were improvisational actors on this on this show. And the stand-ups were great. The improv actors came out, and I know that all I was doing was my character, Chris Norton. I came out as this character that I do, who's this guy who thinks he's the shit, you know, when it comes to sex. I came out, I did him doing this story about the movies he's making, and the audience loved it. They really did dig it. Maybe it's because they were expecting this kind of comedy. It is UCB. It is an improvisational house. But I think, well, that would be something I would do on stage, because, damn, writing jokes is not my thing, you know, so...
Now the documentary, I want to talk about documentary, but first I want to talk about, I saw your post on Facebook. Has your episode of Grey's Anatomy aired yet?
Yeah, it aired last week.
Okay.
Last Thursday.
Now, how is that? Because you were with Donna Pascal, and, like, everyone remembers her from Saturday Night Fever. I mean, she's legendary.
She's a great, great lady. She's got two boys, I think. She's got a husband who's a surgeon. Donna's from Brooklyn. She moved to California. Her husband's a lifelong Californian who surfs. So here's a girl from... Here's a girl from Brooklyn who knows all about surfing because she's got no choice. They lived in Malibu for a while. And I told Donna, and I mean this sincerely, I said, Donna, you were the hottest chick in that movie. Oh, get out. No, you were. You were the hottest girl in that whole flick, you know. And she still got, even on set there, she was getting recognized by crew and cast and people coming up and introducing themselves to her. She had a great show called Angie for 3 years that there are fans even to this day of. She's a real person. There's a damn thing about her that's Hollywood or hypey or star, you know, don't talk to me. Just a cool lady and a goddamn good comic actress, too, you know.
Now, what's it like for you being on set? Because as you said, your show is boom, 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 boom. At set, you do a scene, you wait, you do a scene. Yeah. How do you adapt to that? Because once again, coming from radio, it's a boom, boom, boom.
It is. I like it a lot, man. It's different. It allows me to invest in just a character. I think about things you don't even really think about in radio. I think about intention and where are the beats in the script and what am I going to really be playing here? Stuff that I've never done before and I enjoy immensely. And speaking of Donna, she's a director as well, and was very helpful. You're on set with actors who are experienced and can assist you in any way they can in terms of that. So I dig it, man. I don't mind the waiting. Some people do. Doesn't bother me at all. Although when it gets to be like midnight, sure, I'd like to go home, you know, wouldn't we all? But it's a great, in my opinion, it's a great way to make a living, and it's a natural progression from what I did on the radio, which is acting and creating characters. And let's face it, radio doesn't really exist anymore, so the need to move into new career directions is there, and thank goodness, you know, I get jobs like that.
Now, the documentary, our friend, our mutual friend Jordan Brady produced it. I love Jordan. He's got that nice
Jordan's
beard.
Great man, yeah.
How did it all come about? How did it come about? Because I had just all of a sudden saw it, and I'm like a moron. I'm like, we have Apple TV, but then we have Amazon, and I'm getting it last night. And I'm like, I'm going into the remote, Hendry, and it's your picture coming, but it's not the movie. I'm like, Jesus Christ! Finally, I search it, and I go, okay, so I buy it, and it charges my Amazon account, and it's great. But how did it come about? Because it must be something to get a documentary about you is, you know, that's something pretty amazing.
It is, man. Trust me, it's not lost on me. It blew my mind. And the first thing, what happened was Pat Reynolds called me, or Jordan might have, I forget who, but they said, we'd like to do a documentary. But Patrick Reynolds is our director, and Patrick's the guy that lugged the camera all over the place. Can we take you to lunch? I said, yeah. And so they have, their offices are out at Santa Monica Airport, and which I find endlessly fascinating. They're probably tired of me talking about it, but the fact they're at an airport with this whole line of offices of filmmakers, I don't know. But anyway, maybe they can park their private jets there. But I go out there, and we had lunch, and they said, Phil, we'd like to do a doc about you. You know, you've done this, you've done that. We think it's pretty cool. And the first thing that came to my mind is just what you said, Steve. It's like, wow. I mean, I didn't say this to them, but I thought this is about the coolest thing that could happen is somebody make a doc out of you. So I said to them, to be journalistically real, I don't think I should have anything to do with the production of this. I think I'm your subject. You should create this movie as you see fit. Because I don't think, you know, documentaries are pieces of journalism, and journalism is not worth a pinch if the guy that the story is about is making it, you know. So they agreed. That point forward, it was just a series of events where Pat came out to my house here and interviewed me. Then we did a bunch of interviews in this Cadillac that he rented, which was pretty funny. Then we did interviews like Standing in the Park. Then he was able to nail down all these great guys that you mentioned. There's a list of them that I wish I could remember everybody. Also, Derek Waters from Drunk History is in there. And people that I know and love, like Christine Blackburn, people I've worked with, Mike Crozier from KFI. So he interviewed all of those folks and created the story. I knew that they liked me, so I knew it wasn't going to be a hatchet job or anything. I knew it wasn't going to come out, Phil Hendry, what a piece of crap he really is today, you know. And then the flick came out. And, you know, it started in 2018. My godson, Joe Olander, who's a media guy back in New York, said to me, when are you going to finish that thing anyway? I said, I don't know, man, you know. But all of a sudden, Pat calls me and says, did you see Deadline this morning? Deadline had a piece. And then it started to get some press, and then there it was on TV. So I'm forever gratified and blown away that a documentary was made. That's the coolest kind of filmmaking, if you want my honest opinion.
Oh yeah, I watch documentaries all the time, and you're right; it has to be someone from the outside, because as you said, it's someone. You know, some people just do a spin. It's their point. I don't want to see your point. I want to see the story. So like Netflix has this thing going on right now about the true life homicide detectives in New York. And it comes and they interview the Manhattan South, North, but it's real. It's not like, okay, here's what we think. They're not saying this is, you know, so that's what's great. Now, I want to
ask. Produced by the NYPD.
Yeah, exactly. What made you get into radio? You know, was it something when you were a kid? I mean, because you think it's radio, it's so weird. There was a DJ in Philadelphia, he's still around, named Pierre Robert. He's on WMMR. He's been around since 1980. Okay. Long haired dude with a beard, and now he's a buff and gets in shape. But he's just been doing it forever, and he become a fixture. I mean, to last that long, you know, in one station is amazing. But what was it, just as a little kid you heard the radio, or what made you decide to follow this passion? Because as you can say, it is a tough life.
Oh, I've loved the radio ever since I first heard it. And I actually do remember, this is how old I am, I actually do remember them on radio announcing the death of Buddy Holly, which was 1958, and it was very somber. My brother talked to me about it. I was probably 5 years old. That was my first real memory of radio. Then I remember Elvis Presley on the radio as I drove around with my dad. I remember KFWB was the first rock station we had here in L.A., a top 40 station. And gradually, I just listened like we all did. But the thing that made me really love it was a trip to Canada in the car with my father, my mother, and my three siblings. We were going back to see my grandparents. This would be a four-day trip. How my parents ever muscled four kids into a car, I don't know how that happened, but they did. They kept us entertained. And late at night, as my mom was asleep, everybody's asleep in the car, my father's driving, I would be awake standing up there against the front seat listening to these radio stations. And it was at night. I think that's why Art Bell became so popular. I think we all have memories of the radio at night and how it kept us alive and kept us awake and interested. And that's what happened to me. I heard this guy, and this one guy is creating a universe of impressions, where the city is, what the weather's like, how you doing tonight, here's a song for you. I thought that guy had all the power in the world and all the potential in the world to entertain any way you wanted to. And at that age, I was already beginning to do mimicking voices. And the first mimic I did was of, believe it or not, James Mason. I don't know how that happened as a six-year-old kid, but I was doing James Mason. So the radio became a passion for me. Listening to it, I wanted to know those guys. I wanted to meet them. Where do they broadcast from? What does it look like? And I would get on my bike when I got old enough and rode over to KRLA Radio, which was in the Huntington Sheraton here in Pasadena. And I saw Casey Kasem working. I saw Bob Eubanks. I saw all these guys. And to me, it was the coolest damn work environment you could ever have. This microphone, all these knobs. Here's some music they're playing. And they're controlling this environment and this atmosphere, this reality that we're all hearing. I don't know, man. There's something about it that I dug more than anything.
So how do you get your start in it? Like, okay, when I did comedy, I got out of college. And my mom gave me a paper to this something called the Learning Annex. They used to have these courses called the Learning Annex in Philadelphia.
Oh, yeah.
And you pay like $25 and you went into this. I took the train into Center City and there was a teacher and they taught us, you know, not how to be funny, because I don't think people can be taught to be funny, but they taught you how to put an act together, where to go. And then that's what got the whole thing started. And you start doing it and you start getting better. Well, how did you go about getting your first job? Because, you know, you hear about these like broadcasting schools, but I always think they're like bullshit when I hear like the commercials like, oh, come to, you know, Connecticut Broadcasting. And I'm like,
the Columbia School of Broadcasting. Yeah. Well, I actually answered a Columbia School of Broadcasting ad. I was in Orlando, Florida. I was 19 years old. I knew I wanted to get into radio or be a writer. One of those two. My real impetus was to be a writer. I wanted to be Jack Kerouac. But I loved radio, and I thought, I know what I'll do. I'll get jobs in radio that will support me while I have my writing career. So there was the Columbia School of Broadcasting. I'd been working in construction, being a cement finisher and a laborer and all kinds of crap in Orlando during the build-out to Disney World. I'm living with some buddies. We're all rooming together. And I went down to the Columbia School of Broadcasting in downtown Orlando. I took about three lessons from these guys, and that's really all I needed. But one of them did have the names of some radio stations that were looking for people, and I very gladly gobbled those up. My friend John Lander was doing afternoons at WLOF. The reason why I knew him is he was cousins with this dude that I was digging ditches with, believe it or not. He was actually his brother-in-law. He was married to this guy. This guy, I said to him, you know, I'd really like to get into radio. How do you do that? Well, I'll tell you what, Phil, make it cassette tape. 2 minutes of you doing commercials, 2 minutes of you doing news. Go ahead, send it around, see what happens. That was what I was advised to do, and that's exactly what I did. And I hoofed this thing to radio stations all around the Orlando market. And one little station in Winter Park, Florida, WBJW, which they used to say at WKIS, you get a kiss, but at WBJW, yeah. So anyway, I get there, and I drop off the tape. Lo and behold, I got a call from Jerry Peterson, who was their program director. He said, come on in, Phil. You know, Jerry was about 5'6" with one of those big booming voices, you know, and a Beatle haircut. And I went in, and he offered me the, you know, you've done this before? No, it's my first, you know, well, we got this overnight shift, midnight to 6 on WBJW 1440 Winter Park. That was my first job. They offered this to me. Now, it was a directional signal at night. People in radio know what that means. During the day, the signal goes everywhere. At night, they point it in a certain direction. So I had the station midnight to 6. The directional signal for Phil Hendry pointed to the ocean. As my program director, Jim Boynton, said, there's nothing out there, Phil, but rockets and ship and fish. So you're not talking to anybody. You know, there's Cape Canaveral and there's fish. So that was it, man. That was how I got my job, you know.
But you started off, in the early days, you were doing music. You were spinning.
Yes.
So when do you decide? Because I have a friend who does that at a station here in New Jersey, and it's sort of boring. Like, I tried to tune in one time to hear him talk, but he doesn't talk. And then, like, they go to commercials now, like, every 5 minutes, and then it's the weather that's pre-recorded and that. When you decide that this isn't what you want to do, because, once again, you said you wanted to be a writer first, but you have a creative outlet. So when you're sitting there going, hey, this is Phil Henry from such and such, here's Inagata DeVita by Iron Butterfly, you know, it can't be that fun for you.
No, it was horrible, and it was 17 years of horrible. But because of how I was raised, and because of my view of myself, it was really hard for me to break out with all of these creative instincts that I really had to do voices, to do basically sketch theater on the radio at a time in 1973 when consultants reigned, when Shut Up and Play the Music was really the order of the day. And I bounced from station to station thinking, well, it's going to get better, it's going to get better. And I literally failed upwards, if you will, because I wasn't doing anything on the air that was any good. I was a disc jockey. And it was at the time, Steve, when FM radio in 1970s, when album rock came in, when all you did was like, that was the Grateful Dead, and you talked at this level. You didn't, Grateful Dead there, and we also had the Eagles, and coming up this weekend at the Tangerine Bowl with the Heart, and, you know, that kind of crap. Don't butt your cigarettes in the AstroTurf. And so that was it for 17 years until finally, after a series of firings and personal crises, I looked in the mirror one day and I said, I got to make this happen. I know I got talent for this, and it isn't just spinning records. And so I threw caution to the wind. I was 38 years old, and the thing you tell yourself, and this is what makes it happen for anybody listening, this is how it happens, you stop caring what's going to happen. You stop caring about what's going to happen after you make this move. Even if you fail, you don't care, because you have to express who you are. So as my acting teacher, Daryl Hickman, said, get in there and speak your truth. What if people don't like it, Daryl? Well, you have spoken your truth. And that's always a possibility. People won't like it, but you've got to be who you are. So I made this tape of me doing voices, of interacting with myself, of doing these characters. And I sent this tape around, the first real good audition tape I ever sent. And I got an offer, not from, I thought I was going to be having to go to New York State or somewhere in the Missouri backwater. I got an offer from a station up the road in Ventura to go on the air and do whatever the hell came into my mind. And Rich Galano, my program director at the time, said, just do your show like you're not going to get one phone call. And that freed me to just bring every creative instinct I had to the table. But that's really what kicked it off for me.
Well, when you said, though, the 17 years, you know, and we can all say, just don't care. But we all still have, if we're creative, we have that surging in our head that we worry. And you wake up in the middle of the night, holy shit, how am I going to pay my bills? How did you keep grinding it out when you knew you were good enough, but you knew you were in the wrong place? I think physically. So how do you sit there and all of a sudden say, you could say you look in the mirror, but I mean, was it just, you just were getting, working for assholes? Or because we all want a security of a job. So how did you, I mean, that must have been very, very hard for you. And what kept you focused?
I think what happened for me is that I was keeping a lid on my real creative instinct, at times telling myself, maybe I'm not good enough for this, although I didn't really believe it. There was a period in the 80s when I took photography. I jumped into some acting classes. I took an acting class from the Groundlings. But the thing that I told myself was, why are you quitting? Why are you giving up on this? You know you got talent for this, man. You could go off and be an actor or be a photographer or be a writer, but you know you got talent for this. So I stayed with it, but never really giving myself freedom, because I don't want to get fired, because maybe I'll learn something as I go, because I had a girlfriend at the time who thought I was really hot shit doing this stuff, or I had a house that I had to pay the rent on or something. But now I'm getting into my early to mid-30s, and it ain't, the freshness is wearing off. I see other friends of mine kind of doing better. I see other cats in entertainment doing way better. And I know I'm funnier. I know I'm at least as funny. And the other thing that really bothered me was I've been having to pay lip service to all this crap music I was playing. I like rock and roll, dude. Don't get me wrong. But now classic rock was in. So now I'm an oldies jock. And I have to kiss Led Zeppelin's ass every day. And I get tired of kissing Led Zeppelin's ass. They've had their ass kissed enough, you know. So I got fired from that job, classic rock at KLSX. I finally got a talk show at KFI, but again, I still had the governor on the carburetor, man. I wouldn't let myself go past interviewing people and giving these opinions until I got fired from that job. And that's when something snapped, and I said, if you don't get off your ass, and I don't care, Phil, if people think you're the weirdest motherfucker that ever walked the face of the earth, if you don't get off your ass and do exactly what your instincts tell you to do, you will have no life. You'll be a midday jock on a beautiful music station for the rest of your life, man. You'll be working at Coast for the rest of your life. So, and no offense to anybody at Coast, you know, but not my thing, you know, is what I'm saying. So I did, and I told myself, you could lose, you could fail, this may not work, but I don't care, man, I'm going to do it, you know, because something deep inside of me told me that I would be good enough, and that's what happened. You know, I hope that answered your question.
Yeah, it did. It did. Yeah, because I always wonder, because, you know, everyone goes, you know, now people talk about imposter syndrome and all this stuff that goes on mentally. Now,
that happens all the time, sure. Yeah,
now, yeah, now your first day when you're pulling out this new Phil Hendry, yeah, you know, you're at the station in Ventura.
Yeah.
Are you shitting yourself going, you know, you're getting behind the mic because it's new. I'm sure you're excited because you're like, okay. But what was going through your mind? Were you going, man, what if nobody listens? I mean, I was having fun.
I was having a ball. I wasn't even thinking about nobody listening. It, you know, right away, it clicked. Something clicked in that had never clicked in before. And that was, people can't help but listen to this. I was convinced people would listen to it. You know, now you're hearing the real Phil. And I was doing character voices, interacting. I wasn't doing the phone call thing yet. But I was just, and here's a story. We have here's a congressman who believes that we should have school lunches, you know. And congressman, you know. And what do you think, Congressman? Well, I believe that school lunches are important, although I take my kids' lunch. I eat them. My kids don't eat lunch. I eat their lunch for them. But just stupid crap that, you know, but in character. Then finally, the Gulf War was beginning to heat up. This would have been in August, September of 1990. And we had Desert Shield. So we had American troops that were going to the Middle East. There was a great deal of emotion in the country over that. There was a great deal of emotion in the country over the possibility of war in the Middle East. And so I was listening to this, and I came to the air one day with this Iraqi character that I'd invented. And his name's Raj Finnegan, you know, and I'd like the opportunity to tell you what I think of Saddam Hussein. He's a good guy. You know, a lot of you people got the wrong idea, this kind of crap. And that's when my engineer, Greg Glasser, said, there's people calling, and they want to talk to this Iraqi guy. And I said, really? Yeah. They think he's a real guy. I said, okay, Greg, send the calls through. And that's when I found out that if you're earnest enough, if you are serious enough, and you're not broad and sketchy and silly about it, you can sell anything. You can sell any point of view on the radio. So that if you are talking about witches flying into the turbines of jets on Halloween night, if you're a guy who, look at Phil, I'm not saying that this happens, understand, but I know it's been reported. That's all I'm trying to tell you. You realize you sound crazy. Believe me, folks, I don't believe it myself, but I've got pilots that are telling me they've seen witches and goblins. I don't know, you know. You try to sell the thing as best as you can. People will call, man, and they'll say, run that by me again, man, because I'm a pilot and I've never seen anything like that, you know.
Well, it is funny because I go on TikTok every once in a while. I do this character called Kid Koopy, and I pull my glasses down, I put my hat on, and I was sitting there, and I did it during the Super Bowl when the Eagles were playing. And I had like 10,000 views, and people were like, typical Eagles fan, and they thought I was real, and I was cracking up because because you know what, you're right. You hear, a lot of us were brought up hearing the radio. It's true. You know, it's
not
TV.
It's true.
So how would you develop the characters? Would you just sit there? Would you sit down and, let's say, okay, I need a character for the show tomorrow and write it? Or would you just be, let's say, driving and all of a sudden, you know, like Bobby Dooley pops up in your head? I mean, how did you create the characters?
That's how it happens like that. It happens organic. You hear a voice. You see someone. This being broadcasting, I don't know if visual actors are triggered by a voice or not, but I was. And I would hear voices, and I'd create a character around them. There's not a single character that I've done that is not based on a real person that I've heard. Bobby Dooley was a woman that I heard in the Valley on KABC. She was on the radio calling in about some crap. I don't know. Jay Santos, with a thick Baltimore accent, is a guy that I heard on KFI. Some caller called in and said, you know, I think this whole thing's a bunch of bull crap. And let me tell you something. And I didn't think anybody sounded dumber in my life than that guy. Steve Bozell is based on Dick Vermeil, the head coach of the Philadelphia Eagles. Dick was not from the South, but he broke into tears a lot. And I just want to tell my players I love them, you know, and so that became Steve. So, yeah, absolutely. All characters have to be based on real people. And then the bit that you do is Stephen King, I think, famously said, story follows character. Character does not follow story. So you have this character, and then story flows from the character. You know, if I see a story in the news, immediately a character comes to mind that would do that thing or would believe in that thing or would, you know, behave that way. So that's the process.
Do you think of scenarios that someone might ask a question when you're, because when you go, you're thinking on your feet, but it's like anything. Sometimes you think of a scenario, like with comedy. Oh, well, if someone says this, if I do this bit, they said, oh, well, I can riff off this. Do you have scenarios like when you're Bobby Dooley, if someone calls, oh, you're just an awful bitch? Do you have scenarios in your head already, or do you just go at the moment?
I go at the moment based on the character. So I suppose you could say not so much scenarios, but an already programmed style of response because of who Bobby is, her entitlement, her sociopathy, her control. So if somebody did call and say, you know, you're nothing but a bitch. Mm-hmm. Well, you know, jealousy, you know, her automatic thing would be, you're just jealous of how rich I am and how, you know. If someone called and said, you know, you're nothing but a bitch, I guess you don't have children, do you? There's a million things you could say to somebody like that based upon what the bit is that automatically turns them defensive. And the same thing with Steve Ozell. You know, you sound like a big crybaby. You know something, sir? You've not had my life. If you had my life, if you had my life, you'd understand, you know. So that's Steve. Jason, you know, you're nothing but a punk. Yeah, I lie, you punk. Yeah, you know who the punk is? You're the punk. I deal with punks like you all the time. You're just a punk. You know, what'd you call me? A punk? Yeah.
Well, you know what's fascinating about the documentary? I had never seen you in action with the phone. Okay, I mean, we hear it, and it was very cool. I mean, I was thinking, you don't know what to think because, as I said, you're so good at it and you had the timing, but you're actually sitting on the phone, then you're doing this. Yeah. And then, I mean, how long did you take? How long did it take you to get that down? Because that's an art form, man. That's hard shit.
Well, the thing of it is, you know, when you're doing that kind of comedy, you have to, you're replicating reality. And so it isn't that you sit down and plan it. You just, well, how do I make this work? Well, I'm on the phone. How does it happen? What does it sound like on the phone? Hi, Phil, I think you're great. Well, thank you. So what I was doing is I had the mic pot that I was manipulating up, and the mic pot being the volume knob, manipulating that up and down. The phone pot always stayed open, and I would just move the phone far away from me. How you doing, Bill? Down comes the mic pot. I'm fine, Phil. Great. Well, you do that enough times, it's like this. You know, it's back and forth. You're moving your mouth away from the phone. Sometimes you're on top. Like Steve Dooley, Bobby's husband, is always, Steve's here. Steve, what do you think?
Well, you know what?
Don't blow the phone, Steve. I can't have him. You know, so he's using the phone like a lot of dumbasses use the phone, talking too loud into it. And that's how you create character. And the way you pace it is you take your breaths in an unnatural place. Like, you know, most would say, here's my husband, Steve.
Thank you, Bobby. I'm Steve.
The reality would be, here is my husband, Steve.
Thank you.
And, you know, so she took that breath a half a second before you would. And it almost sounds like the voices are overlapping a little bit. But so, you're trying to do, what you're doing is you're endeavoring to create the reality that you need to create to make the bit happen. You know?
So you're in Ventura. Now, when do you break large? Is that when you go to Miami or do you go to Minneapolis first?
I went to Atlanta. I got flown to Atlanta in the fall of 91 by Jim Ashbery, great guy. And I didn't take the job. I don't even think maybe he didn't offer me the job, but they flew me out there. I don't even remember being on the air there at all, but they interviewed me for this gig. They had a late night gig. They really wanted to, you know, they'd heard about me. And I think maybe I turned down the job because what happened was I came back to Ventura and then I got canned here in Ventura because of something I did on the air. I called Jim. I said, Jim, I'm available for that job. He hired me right away, to his credit, bless his heart. And I got flown to Atlanta in the spring of 92 to begin my job there. So
how hard is it though? I mean, well, you're going in for a year. I mean, you don't know how long you're going to be there. It must be hard moving. I mean, it's, do you rent a like nice place? Do you sit there and move all your furniture? Do you keep storage here? What do you do?
What happened in Atlanta, man? What happened in Atlanta? I got to Atlanta, and I right away, I didn't know what I was doing, man. I shipped my car. You can actually ship your car for $300. And I flew, And I got to Atlanta, and I don't know, I got a Motel 6 in the worst part of Atlanta. I didn't know where it was, but there I am in a Motel 6, and I'm listening to a couple who I guess lives at the motel fighting in the next room, and all kinds of screaming and shit. So I get to the station, and who helped me was Clark Howard. You remember Clark Howard, the consumer affairs guy?
Yeah.
Clark was local on WSB at that time, and his producer was a really, really wonderful lady named Kim Curley. And Kim says, well, where are you living? I said, down in you know, Motel 6. So she took me up to, do you know that, and this is a perfect Clark Howard producer thing, Courtyard by Marriott has a discount this week, you know. So I got, she drove me up to the Courtyard by Marriott right there in middle Atlanta, not far from the station. I got that. And then she took me driving, Kim, bless you, Kim, wherever you are, she took me driving around town. And I found this awesome duplex, not more than, I don't know, a quarter mile from the radio station. Rented that from this elegant elderly woman. And the guy that was her sort of property keeper says, how you doing, Phil? The lady lives down the street. She needs to talk to you before you rent it. Sure. And I walk into this living room, and there she is almost in a throne with her hair up, and she has all the southern things. How are you, Phil? How you doing? Great. You in radio, huh? Yeah. I used to do promo work for Bill Drake. I go, you're kidding me. No, I broke James Brown in this town. So she was a promo, she was doing a record promotion, and she broke some of James Brown's records in Atlanta. So we, boom, hit it off on the radio thing, and I rented the place. And I was home, man. Atlanta, socially, is extremely conservative. Politically, it's very liberal, but socially, it's a church-going town. That and some damn good food, you know, that I think would rival San Francisco in some ways. And I had a lot of fun. I had a good fan base. I did my characters, and I Steve Bozell had his own show on Saturday nights. Only then he was named Steve Warnell. I literally just did this one character for on a Saturday night, and they let me do all that shit. So it was a great first step from Ventura.
When did you start feeling really confident in your on-air talent? When was it that you sat there, and you, even if you got fired, it doesn't make a difference. You know, when did you sit there and go, all right, man, you know, they can fire me, but I'm fucking good.
You know? Ventura, within 2 months, within 3 months. I went up to San Francisco to visit my friends Don and Pam. And for the first time, and Don's my best friend, Don Olander and Pam Olander. And Donnie and I have known each other since we were 12. He was in the banking business, you know, but somehow we've been close friends. And I said to him as he picked me up at the airport, I said, I never said this to him before. I never said this to anybody before. I said, you know, you got to listen to me on the radio now, man. I'm doing some good shit. He goes, really? I go, yeah. And I had a tape, and I played it. I was proud of myself. I was proud of the stuff I was doing. It was making me laugh, which is, you know, Steve, the first requisite. I mean, if you don't think you're funny, then who's going to find you funny? Yeah. And I was laughing at my own stuff, and I played it for Don, and he thought it was hysterical. And so the Christmas of 1990 was when I said, you know what, kid? You know, you did good, man. You're doing a good job. Keep pushing in this direction. Yeah.
So the documentary hit on this too. When do you end up coming back to LA? That's sort of like the big time, right? Because as you said, it's your hometown. And that's like anything. Yeah. When I did comedy back in the day, you go out on the road for 2 weeks, but when you came back to play Philadelphia, you kicked ass because you were tight and you were a thing. So how did you end up coming back to LA?
So I was in Atlanta, then I got bumped to Minneapolis. I got fired in Atlanta, went to Minneapolis. Something magical happened in Minneapolis. They didn't fire me. They offered me an extension on my deal, which I thought for sure I was going to get canned because they used to put me on the overnights to punish me for some of the shit I was doing. And I got hired in Miami by a wonderful guy named Bob Green, who was with Cox Broadcasting. Bob is our station manager down there. He hired me. He said, go for it, Phil. And I really, really found my stride in Miami. We had a great audience. We had a great radio station that did personality talk. We were not doing news talk, which meant dolphin football, baseball, chicks, South Beach, booze. This is what we talked about, you know. I was able to do my political shit because it was all a put-on, you know, so people enjoyed listening to me sucker all these callers. Like the lady said to me at a remote, you're the guy that does all those fake voices, huh? So I said, yes, I am. So in Miami, we got boxcar numbers. It gets to be the summer of 96, and David G. Hall, who's also a great programmer, calls me, and he says, Phil, what to bring to L.A., man? We've got an opening at night. And I said, you got it, brother. So I flew to L.A. on the 4th of July because we had a golf tournament out here. I met David. He had the deal for me. I signed it. I went back to Miami. I told everybody there, and I think Bob knew because it's the same company, Cox Broadcasting. And at that time, Bob had said to me, Cox, this station's being sold to Paxson. You have two options. You can go to Orlando or L.A. Both stations want you. And I'm like, well, come on, you know. I said, I grew up in L.A. So I got hired, and it was a big, big moment for me. I knew what I was doing on the air. I knew it was good. I was going back to the second largest market in the country, and it was where I grew up. So I would have a real good handle on what was happening. And I told myself, this has been such a journey. I'm taking the train home, man. I'm not going to fly. I want to see the country that I just had to hoof my ass through. So I took Amtrak all the way home, got to L.A., got my rental car, got into this housing that KFI put me up in, and that was it. I was really on top of the world. I felt like a success. I felt like it had all been worth it. I might even have been a little cocky, all that shit, you know.
So when does it start going south where you're just tired of radio? We know radio imploded, and it is true. You know, you see, I swear to God, I'll put Amazon Music on the car sometimes, but you put on the radio, and I'm like, okay, I don't want to hear this song by Journey. So I switched to the other classic rock station, and they're playing that song by Journey. And the sports talk in Philadelphia sucks because all these guys are just bitter assholes. I mean, it's just, but you sit there and go, oh. Yeah. But so you're doing right. Well. I mean, you're popular. You're going into syndication. Were you just not happy?
Well, I was not in a good home life. You know, my marriage was not good. I was working my ass off. I put on all kinds of weight. And it was a real hard, hard gig for me. Every day coming up with this kind of magic is very, very difficult. On top of that, the show was hard to affiliate. It was hard to sell. You know, I was in an environment on a platform where now it was being treated as, you know, an entertainment product. And they were trying to put it on news talk stations. They were trying to sell it to national advertisers, and they were not having a whole lot of success, and they were not really having success affiliating it, until finally, you know, the deal just went south, and I, to my everlasting regret, I was getting offers to do television. I did some pilots, and I did I don't know, like a month on the unit, so I had some regular TV gigs happening. But I thought maybe there was still a world for awaiting me in radio, and I signed the worst radio deal I've ever signed in my life with this company that kept me tied down for 6 years. They had a 3-year option. At the end of the first 3 years, I said to them, would you please let me out of my option? No, they wouldn't. So it's 6 years of hell. In the middle of that, you know, trying to do acting gigs and trying to do voiceover gigs. But, you know, you're right, man. The show was increasingly difficult to screen because we weren't live. We were being tape delayed. So what do you do with an audience that isn't there, you know? We had a revenue sharing deal with this company that wasn't the most profitable. So really, you know, radio was going south and Phil Henry was going south with it, you know? The advertisers were fleeing talk radio because it was too controversial, and they stuck with the right-wing stuff because I guess they had a lot of older demos in the AM band that would listen to it. And they invested in sports talk, which you were just talking about, because that's controversial radio that doesn't matter. You could have two guys screaming about who the quarterback ought to be for the Jets, and at the end of the day, who cares, you know? So that's when I just segued out of it and went into digital, started doing this podcast. I got the rights to all of my material. We put up the website, archived it, and went from there.
Was it hard to get the rights to your material? Because it's...
No, it was not.
Okay,
it wasn't, because Doug Urbanski at the time was my manager. He said, you know, you need the rights to that stuff. Craig Kitchen, the president at Premier, said yes. You know, they granted me the rights to all of that stuff, going back to Miami, which was a Cox Broadcasting station at the time. And then I started doing the digital show. I started to do a bunch of pilots. I got some guest starring things. And tried to juggle that world as the best way I knew how. And frankly, you know what I was doing more than anything else, Steve, is I was kicking it, man. I had some money in the bank and a big retirement, and I was just living on the beach, man. I mean, I literally live 100 yards from the sand right now, and I just decided that I'd start living like I was on vacation for a while.
Well, you should. You're living. You had a grueling schedule. Now, when do you start transitioning into voiceovers? Because I mean, that's perfect. I mean, if someone was listening to your show And they're saying, okay, well, he can do, he fools people. I mean, was that an easy transition? Like, because people probably knew you in LA.
I got offered, the first thing, I was in town, I was back in LA not more than, when was the first one? I was living in Westlake Village. Yeah, I got offered a thing on King of the Hill like in 99 by Mike Judge and those guys. And I was like ecstatic, you know, and my agent calls me up and says, you know, Phil, you've been kicked out of the union. Did you know that? Oh, you mean I didn't pay? Yeah, you're on dishonorable withdrawal. So you got to get your ass in gear there. So I had to go and I had to get my SAG membership up to score. But I got hired to do King of the Hill, which was phenomenally fun. And then they've hired me to do some Futuramas. And then it kind of just began there. But I was working during that time at Premiere and at KFI. When the radio gig ended and I was just doing digital work, I continued on with voiceover stuff. I was still getting hired for King of the Hill, you know. I was still getting hired. And Disney hired me for a thing called The Replacements, which was a little kid thing. And so that became, you know, another avenue of revenue. I can't say that I was really in love with doing animation at that time, but I've grown to like it because I've grown to understand character work a lot better than I do. And now, you know, we just got done doing a run on F is for Family, which is has ended, unfortunately. I worked with Tom. I worked with some great people at Disney. Let me ad lib my parts in a show called The 7D. Sherry Stoner and Tom Ruger. So now you get offered jobs where people know what your strengths are, and they want you to work there, and they're like, "Oh, we know what you know how to do, so will you do this for us?" And that's the best, man, to be honest with you.
What do you like about digital now? Because you're.
Oh, I got one more story. I got hired early on in Rick and Morty as Principal Vagina. That's the biggest success story in terms of recognition. I had eye surgery. Okay, I had a muscle imbalance in one eye. And I was going in for eye surgery and laying down. The anesthetologist suddenly looks at me and goes, "Were you Principal Vagina in Rick and Morty?" I go, "Yeah." And then everything went black.
So, now, your website, it's great. And it's a good website. You know, that's so important. I was just thinking, I was talking to my wife about this the other day. I wanted to check a menu on a website. Just check a menu. But they always make you want to order first. I'm like, no, you can't navigate it. Yours, you can navigate. What do you like about digital world right now? What I mean, you're happy, and I could tell in the documentary, and you have the acting, but what makes this, is it because you're at home, it's because you can do the content when you want, or what makes you happy with this?
Well, first of all, it's where it's at, man. That's where the world is now, the digital realm. You know, radio is, no one's listening to it anymore, so I feel like I'm in the middle of it. I can could do whatever I want to do, keeping in mind, you know, that you got to make advertisers happy on the digital platforms as much as you did in radio. But there's a wider array of advertisers who probably are more tolerant of things than others. But you still have to be conscious of that. But you can do just about any damn thing you want to do as long as you put a, you know, rated R on the end of the thing. I can create any way I want. I can work when I want, not when I want. We have, like I say, our archive and our subscriber base, and we have a you know, good mix of advertisers in there. So it's a business that you run, which is kind of like running a restaurant, man. You're cooking the food, you're cleaning the toilet, you're doing everything, man. You're monitoring all of your subcontractors, you're making sure that the web people are developing it right, you're making sure that stuff's getting posted. You're working your ass off, but you own it, you run it. It's like your own little radio station, if you will, and it can be as big or as small as you want it to be.
Now, what do you, when you were on the radio, people, you would tell people that the guest was you. Did you have to do that for some reason, or is that just something that the station said?
That's what Craig Kitchen came to me, who was running Premiere, and I was still syndicated at the time. He said, "We found, Phil, that time spent listening on your show goes up when people know what you're doing." So that was a calculated decision based on research that said people listen longer and more often if they know you're doing the characters. Now, what I should have said to him was, they figure it out anyway, you know, but I think they wanted to speed the process up. And so at the end of every hour, I would say, by the way, that was me doing all the voices, as a way of, I don't know that it had any impact, to be honest with you. I think we had a really loyal quarter hour. I think we got a big, by quarter hour, I mean, these are people that listen consistently to you through a quarter hour, and that's what ratings are based on. But our show is on traditional talk stations, so you're trying to sell a comedy show in the middle of all this serious news talk, you know.
Now, what was your favorite character? I remember you had a character that was the black man in Orange County. He used to sit there and go, I'm a black man in Orange County.
Oh, I don't remember that character.
No, I remember you did a phone call one time.
I had a gay guy.
Oh, yeah, gay man. Yeah, it was a gay man. Okay.
A gay man, a gay journalist. Doug Danger. I'm with the Orange County Courier. And let me tell you something, Phil. I don't play this anymore, these straight people. You know I'm gay, right? Yeah, I know. Okay. So this guy says to me, I said, I'd like a pack of Cools. I don't know. I'd like a pack of Viceroy cigarettes. And the guy looks at me like, what? And so I grabbed him by the shirt and pulled him over the counter. I said, you think I'm gay? Well, I am. You know, this kind of shit. So what I did is I created that character as a gay character, not to be, you know, quote unquote, sort of a stereotypical sissy, but to be a confrontational, in your face, ready to throw down guy. Because at that time, ACT UP was happening. And ACT UP was a very aggressive, sometimes too aggressive group of gay activists who really wanted the AIDS epidemic to be up and center in the face of in front of everybody's face, and they did not want it to be marginalized anymore, and they were being, you know, pretty loud and calamitous about it. And so that was what Doug Danger was based on. Let me tell you something, Phil. I'm a gay man and a gay journalist. Understand? It got to be such a joke that people would laugh when they heard him say, look, I'm Doug Danger. Yes, you're a gay man, a gay journalist. What, are you a homophobe? You don't like that? And I liked it. I liked the character so much that I thought it should have gotten a GLAAD award or something. But, you know, it's probably, maybe some people thought it was being too, maybe instead of blackface, it was gayface.
Right.
But I felt it was a great satire on activist politics. Or satirization on activist politics, and I like the idea of a gay guy ready to kick someone's ass if they don't like it, you know.
Now,
because what happened was the callers that called in, there was never any caller that tried to mock him for being gay. They took the bait. They were going to fight him too, you know. He said, you know, you and what army, friend? Okay, you throw down with me. I go eyeball to eyeball with you, man. You go blind. You know, stuff like that. So
what's your future, Phil? Well, what do you want to do? I mean, do you want to really get into the serious acting? Because you're getting in roles. I mean, what would you, like, if someone said to you right now, hey, Phil, here's what you're going to do. You have your choice. You can do voiceovers. You can do this. What would you choose? Because you've had success in all of them.
I've got nothing but a big empty road in front of me, Steve. It's dark. There's no future. No, if I could have my druthers, it would be to get hired on a show, you know, have a contract with a TV show and play a character. Play maybe some crazed hillbilly, or play some character that you know, I can play. That would be fun. That would be security, and that would be, you know, doing comedy, which is my strength, and be working in a visual medium, which is where I think I really probably belonged all along, to be honest with you. But who knows? I mean, we all have to go through our stages, man, to get where we need to be. But that would be fun. The other one would be to just continue doing what I'm doing and see this podcast that we do blow up. And I've got a pilot that I wrote for a thing based on my characters, and it's situated in a certain environment that we pitched about 2 years ago with some really good writers and a great showrunner. And I'd love to sell that thing, you know, maybe go out and repitch it again. So sell a show and produce it, work on a show as an actor with a contract, or just watch what we're doing right now continue to grow listeners and money.
One final question.
Sure.
Looking back at your career, what makes you the proudest? What makes, when you look back and you say, what is that crowning achievement, or that's something you just, that really makes you proud? Is it just that you've lasted, or what is it?
The day I decided I would have the guts to do what I felt I knew how to do well, even if it crashed and burned. Because, you know, when you tell yourself that, you know it ain't going to crash and burn. If you got enough confidence in your talent, you say, I'm going to go out there and I'm going to walk into the fire, man. And if I don't come out, that's fine with me. I walked into the fire. But anybody that actually says that deep down has the confidence to know I'm going to make it through, you know. And I felt that way. My first 6 months on the air at KVEN, I said, this show's going to get syndicated in 2 years. I was wrong. It took me six or seven, you know. But I knew right away. But the day that I decided to leave all that shit behind, caring about what people thought, caring about what program directors thought, caring about what listeners said, caring about, you know, how I was seen by other people, and I just said, I'm going to break out on my own and be Phil Hendry, that's the day that I'm the proudest of. That will always be the day I'm proudest of, you know.
Well, thank God you did that, because you brought a lot of people entertainment. People,
thank you, brother.
Go to Phil's website, philhendryshow.com. Anything else you want to plug? The documentary?
Go watch Hendry, the doc. Yeah.
Go on your Amazon, right? People. Search it. Go on Amazon. Get on Amazon. It's only $4.99. That's great. You go to a movie, it's like $25. $4.99, you get a bottle of bourbon, you can have a good night.
There you go, yeah. Although it cost me $5.99, so I don't know where you went. Oh, I got it on Sling. Anyway.
Also, go to my website. You can find 1,001 episodes, coopertalk.net. You can email me at cooper@coopertalk.net. Instagram at CooperTalk1, Twitter at CooperTalk. Remember, I'm Steve Cooper. I'm only as hip as my guest. Don't forget, drink your water, eat your vegetables, take your vitamins, and I'll talk to you next time.